We started it yesterday. I'll just recap. Here's the Lagrangian. We're starting out with SU2 gauge theory, plus a complex doublet, scalar doublet, transforming under the SU2 local gauge symmetry. And we have a potential V of phi, which is what I wrote down before, minus mu squared phi dagger phi plus lambda phi dagger phi squared. And then also, what else do I need to tell you? The covariant derivative, I can write down d mu phi was d mu plus ig, and then I have the generator, TA, the gauge fields, and then acting on the doublet. And the generators, of course, are related to the Pauli matrices. They're just the Pauli matrices divided by 2. So we minimize the potential. We want phi dagger phi to be v squared over 2. V is the VeV. And we can solve for V by minimizing the potential. It's just the square root of mu squared over lambda. All right. So now we want to go through the same argument that we did for the case of the abelian gauge symmetry. We want to write phi, parameterize phi, in terms of real scalar fields. And then we do a gauge transformation to remove those would-be Goldstone bosons from the theory. So let's write phi as the exponential of I TA CA divided by V, and then 0 V plus H of X divided by the square root of 2. OK, so we have 4 real fields. H of X, and then C, 1, 2, and 3. OK, so now we want to remove the C fields from the theory just by doing a gauge transformation. We say phi goes to e to the minus I CA TA over V, acting on phi. So of course, these two terms will cancel out. And I'm just left over with what I had here. So in essence, we're free to do a gauge transformation where our scalar field is purely in the two components and purely real. OK. So now what I want to do is write down the covariant derivative term and see how we get masses for our gauge boson degrees of freedom. So that term was d mu phi dagger d mu phi. And so I want to expand this out. I'll have a square root of 2 squared, so that'll give me a factor of a half. I'll have this part dagger, so that will give me 0 and then v plus h. Then I have one covariant derivative acting on here, so I'll write that as derivatives going to the left. So that would be d mu going to the left. And then since it's daggered, I'll have minus I G T A A A mu. OK? That was this term. Now I have this term. So I have also a covariant derivative, but going to the right, plus ig ta a mu, and then I'll have 0 v plus h. Oh, I should use different letters here. So I won't get confused. I'll call this b. So we have, first of all, the kinetic term for the Higgs boson in this theory, little h. The derivative will act on this part. It doesn't, when it acts on the v, since v is a constant, in order to minimize the energy, it will just give 0. So it'll be left over with 1 half d mu h squared. So we have the kinetic term for our leftover scalar degree of freedom. The cross terms will end up vanishing once I combine this term with that term. And then I'll have the following. So I'll have the terms that go like a squared. So that will look like this. So I'm going to plug in that TA is a Pauli matrix divided by 2. So I'll have g squared, since I have 2 powers of g. I'll have divided by 8, since I have 2, and then a 1 half from each of the generators. And so then I'll have 0 v plus h. So now I have the gauge fields contracted with a Pauli matrix. So I'll have gauge field 1 times Pauli matrix 1. And so I should put in that 2 by 2 matrix. So where I have T3, I'll have gauge field 3. And then Pauli matrix 1 and 2 will give me A1 and A2. So that will give me A1 minus IA2, and then A1 plus IA2. OK, so that's just one of these terms. And then I have to square it, because I'll have one from over here. And then I want to multiply that by this vector, 0 v plus h. OK. So the first term, again, is the same, d mu h squared. And then I can multiply all of this stuff out, and I get the following, 0 g squared over 8. I'll have v plus h squared. And then I'll have a mu 1 squared plus a mu 2 squared plus a mu 3 squared. Like this. So what do we find? Well, if I just look at the parts in the second term proportional to V, you can see that all three gauge bosons, A1, A2, and A3, all get a mass. That mass term is just proportional to g squared v squared over 8. So I can write it out more explicitly. I have the kinetic term. And then I have m a squared over 2, a1 squared plus a2 squared plus a3 squared times 1 plus h over v squared, where ma is just g times v over 2. OK? So we've given a mass to all three gauge bosons in the theory. SU2 has 3 generators, so it has 3 gauge fields. So just to go through the counting, yeah?
Could you explain the sign for the mass term? Like, a mass term for a scalar field, say, comes with a negative sign. This comes with a positive sign.
Yeah, so if you look at the, so once you look at the propagator for the gauge fields in Fourier space, you want the sign of the p squared part to have opposite sign to the mass squared term. OK? So it turns out if you looked at the kinetic term for the gauge boson, you would have a minus p squared. And so that's why I want the sign of the mass term to be plus ma squared.
Okay.
Okay, so the pole is where p squared is equal to ma squared. Okay, let's go through the counting of degrees of freedom. So in the unbroken theory, we have two gauge fields. So we have 2 times 3 gauge degrees of freedom. The 3 is for the different fields, A1, A2, and A3. And for each of them, we have 2 polarizations. So we have 6 total. And then we also had our complex scalar doublets, which has 4, because it's 2 complex scalar fields. We have 2 components. Each one is complex. We have 2. Gives us 4. So this is real scalar degrees of freedom. OK, so the sum of this, I guess, is 10. And then in the broken theory, we have 3 degrees of freedom, 3 polarizations, and 3 gauge fields. And we just have 1 leftover scalar degree of freedom, this real scalar little h. OK, great. So we're not losing any degrees of freedom. They just get reshuffled from what we thought of as a scalar to the longitudinal components of the gauge bosons. So we're doing pretty good. We have 3 massive gauge bosons in this theory. In the standard model, we know that there are 3 massive gauge bosons, the W plus, the W minus, and the Z. But it's not quite like the standard model. So here, we have 3 massive gauge bosons. A1, A2, and A3. In the standard model, there's also 3 massive gauge bosons, W plus, W minus, and the Z. The difference, however, is in this theory, the masses of all of the gauge bosons are the same, MA. In the standard model, the masses are different. We have a mass for the W and a separate mass for the Z. And they're not equal to each other. Remember, the mass of the W was around 81 GeV. The mass, or 80 GeV. The mass of the Z was 91 GeV. OK, so they're similar, but they're not the same. We need a theory in which they can be the same. The other thing about the standard model is that we also have a massless gauge field, the photon. And OK, we don't have any massless gauge fields left over in this theory. OK. So we need to extend our gauge group if we want to describe the standard model. And that's what we're going to do now. So we want to write down the Lagrangian for the standard model. I need to tell you a couple of things. We need to know what the gauge group is. So we want to describe the W, the Z, the photon, and also the gluons. I need to tell you what the degrees of freedom are. So how do I include fermions in the theory? And also, what are their quantum numbers? For the fermion and the scalar. Okay. So, what is the gauge group? Well, the gauge group that works is the following. So the group G is SU3. This SU3 is for the strong interaction. So the gluons will come from this non-abelian gauge symmetry. Those gluons couple to what we call color. So I attach a subscript. Well, let me just write C here for color. So this is the theory of quantum chromodynamics, QCD, and the C stands for color. Okay. So in the standard model, it seems that the gluons are all massless. So the theory of the strong interaction is, in a sense, orthogonal to the other parts of the gauge group, which have to do with electroweak symmetry breaking. Now we have the other parts of the group. So we'll start with an SU2 symmetry, because an SU2 symmetry almost worked for the non-abelian Higgs model to give us something like the standard model. But it doesn't quite work by itself. And so we're going to increase the group to include an additional U1 gauge symmetry. So in essence, we have three different gauge groups, and the total gauge group is just the product of all three. Now, we attach subscripts to say what these groups are named. This, we put an L here for SU2 left, and a Y here for hypercharge. And this is the electroweak gauge group. So L is for left, and Y stands for hypercharge. So there's no electromagnetism in what I'm running down so far. This is not going to be the U1 that corresponds to electromagnetism. That will emerge, as we'll see, as a combination of generators from this group and this group. Okay, so that is the gauge group. And then I have to tell you how the different degrees of freedom couple to the gauge fields. So I need to specify the quantum numbers of all of the fermions and the scalars. So here are the fields. And I want to tell you what their quantum numbers are. And when I denote the quantum numbers, it's going to be, I have three gauge groups, so I have to tell you what the quantum numbers are under all three gauge groups. All right. So we want to describe all of the particles that I told you about before. We had quarks, we had leptons, which include both charged leptons and neutrinos. So I want to write down all of those fields. So we'll start with the quarks. So we're going to start with a field called Q left. This will be a left-handed quark field. And it will be a doublet under SU2 left. So this will be U left, D left, as the two components under SU2. So the quantum numbers here are, because it's a quark field, it's in the fundamental representation of SU3. So I'll write that as a 3. It's a doublet under SU2 left. And so that's also in the fundamental representation of SU2. And then I have to tell you what the quantum numbers are for hypercharge. And so That is a sixth. Do you have a question? No? Oh, okay. All right. Now we have the right-handed quark field. So that, again, it's a quark. It has to be a triplet under color, but it will be a singlet under SU2 left, and its hypercharge will be two-thirds. And we have a right-handed down quark. So that'll be a triplet, a singlet, and its hypercharge will be minus a third. Okay? So the structure is all of the quarks are in the fundamental representation of SU3, but only the left-handed fields will transform under the SU2 part of the gauge group. That's why we attach an L here. It only couples to the left-handed chiralities of the fields. Doesn't interact with the right-handed chiralities. Those are singlets under this gauge group. And then each field also has its own charge under this local U1 symmetry hypercharge. And you can see that, well, the interaction is chiral. The left-handed and the right-handed fields have different quantum numbers. OK. The other thing we have in the standard model is that we have, for unknown reasons, three copies of every field with the same quantum number. So those are the different generations. For quarks, for example, we have up quarks, charm quarks, and top quarks, which all have the same quantum numbers under the gauge symmetry, but just have different masses. And so I need to include an additional index that describes flavor or generation. So I'll just write an I here. So this labels generation. OK. So now we also have the leptons. So we'll start out with a left-handed lepton doublet. So under SU2, it'll be a doublet. And the components will be nu left, e left. And so these will correspond to the neutrino and the charged lepton, the electron. The quantum numbers will be, it'll be a singlet under SU3, a doublet under SU2, and the hypercharge is minus a half. We have E right, which is just by itself. So it will be a singlet under SU3, a singlet under SU2, and hypercharge minus one. Now, in the standard model, we won't have any neutrino masses. And so the only neutrino that will matter, if it's massless, is just the left-handed component. If we did want to include neutrino masses, remember the mass terms in the Lagrangian pair up the left-handed and the right-handed fields. And so we would need to introduce a right-handed neutrino into the theory as well. So if we did want to introduce that term, I'll put it in brackets, we would introduce a field nu right. And it turns out it would have to be a singlet under all of the gauge symmetries. OK? But for the moment, let's throw it away. The standard model is defined, in a sense, for massless neutrinos, just historically, just because we don't know exactly how to include contributions to the Lagrangian from this particular field. OK, so we're going to neglect this one for now. OK, we also have generations for all three, for the different lepton fields. For example, for the electron, there's the electron, the muon, and the tau. That's just labeled by generation. And then lastly, we have the scalar field, which is going to be the Higgs field. And it will be very similar to what we did in the non-abelian Higgs model, We're going to have the Higgs field be a doublet under SU2. And I'm just going to label the components as H plus and H zero. So it'll be a singlet under color, because we're not going to break color. It'll be a doublet under SU2, and its hypercharge will be 1/2. So this is the scalar. This will be a doublet, complex doublet, Higgs field. So it's the same as what we called phi before. All right. Now we have the gauge fields. We have gauge bosons. So for color, we have the gluon fields, which I'll call a little g mu, and then it will have a group index A. The gluon field is in the adjoint representation, so there are 8 different values. There are 8 generators in the for SU3. So this index A will go from 1 to 8. Then we have SU2 left. So the field I'll denote by W with index A. And of course, this field will be in the adjoint representation of SU2. There's 3 generators, so we have 3 different gauge fields here. So A goes from 1 to 3. And then for the U1 hypercharge, we'll have a gauge field, which we'll call B mu. And it's a U1, so there's only 1 gauge field in this case. Now, each one of these gauge groups will have its own gauge coupling. So for the strong interaction, we'll write the gauge coupling as G sub S. For SE2 left, I'll just write it as little g. And for the U1, it will be G prime. So these will be the couplings for all 3 gauge groups. OK. So far, so good. You might be worried, or at least skeptical. You know, why did I pick these particular quantum numbers to assign to the fields? You can think of it as more of an empirical question. Given certain fields that we have observed in nature, how can I possibly assign the quantum numbers in order to successfully reproduce the observations? And so that's why I chose these particular values. It's from a phenomenological point of view, it works to describe the observations. So that's why I have to choose these, I have to make these choices. So let's write down the standard model Lagrangian. We'll divide it up into different terms. We have the gauge part. We have the fermion part. We have the scalar part. And then we'll have Yukawa interactions, which we'll see will be necessary to give masses to the different standard model fermions. So we'll go through it each term one by one. The gauge part is exactly what you'd expect for a gauge theory. We have different kinetic terms for each of the 3 gauge groups. There's one for the strong force. There's one for the SU2 part. And then we have -1/4, B mu nu, B mu nu. Hopefully the notation is clear, When I write the corresponding letter for the gauge field with two indices, I'm talking about the gauge field strength tensor. So this would be the field strength tensor for SC3 color, for SC2 lefts, and for hypercharge. OK. Then we have the fermion part. So mass terms, according to the gauge symmetry, are forbidden. They're forbidden just because I have a chiral interactions of the gauge fields. Left and right-handed fields transform differently. As you can see, they have different quantum numbers. So I'm forbidden from running down a mass term by hand in the Lagrangian for the fermions. But of course, I still have the kinetic terms. So I have to sum over all the different fermion species, which I'll call psi. And I just have the Dirac Lagrangian for a massless fermion. I have the scalar part, which will look very similar to what we had before with the non-abelian Higgs model, except I just have to write little, just have to write h's instead of phi's. D mu h dagger d mu h minus v of h, where v of h is what I had before, minus mu squared h dagger h plus lambda h dagger h squared. All right. So it works very similar to the case of just purely SU2. What we'll do now is first consider the scalar part of the Lagrangian to see how we get masses for the gauge fields. So first of all, we want to work in unitary gauge. Where h is purely real and purely in the two components. And the VEV v is the same as what we had before, the square root of mu squared over lambda. All right. So now I just want to write down the covariant derivative term. It's slightly more complicated from the non-abelian Higgs model. There we only had one gauge group to worry about, the SU2. Here we have two gauge groups to worry about since our Higgs field transforms under both SU2 left and U1y. So I need to write down two gauge interactions in the covariant derivative. I have d mu plus ig over 2. The generator is the Pauli matrix divided by 2. And then I have the gauge field, WA mu. And now I have also the gauge interaction for hypercharge. So I have I times G prime. I have to put in the charge, the quantum number for the charge of this field under hypercharge. And recall it was a half. So I should divide by 2. And then I have the gauge field, B mu. And then I have acting on H. OK, and H is 1 over square root of 2, 0, b plus h, like this. OK, so I'm just going to expand out everything in the covariant derivative as a matrix acting on this doublet. So I have a half from both of them. I'll have an I. So on the diagonal terms, I have the part contributed by the W3 and also the part contributed by B mu. So that will look like G W3 mu, and then I'll have plus G prime B mu. Here, I'll have the same thing, except because it's T3, I'll have a minus sign here, minus G W3 mu, and then the hypercharge gauge field just lives on the diagonal in SE2. Then for the off-diagonal terms, I'll have sigma 1 and sigma 2. So that will give me G times W1 mu, minus I W2 mu. And then here I'll have the same thing, just with a plus sign. Okay, so I have this 2 by 2 matrix. Yes?
So we said that the scalar field had non-zero quantum number for the SU2 gauge, or SU3 gauge.
It's a singlet, which is why I wrote 1 there. So it does not transform under SU3.
Okay. So what's the difference then between having a 0 quantum? Oh.
Yeah, it's a bit of notation. So this is a good question, just to be clear what's going on. For a non-abelian group, if I have a 1, that means it's a singlet, it's in the trivial representation, it does not transform under that group for a non-abelian group.
But if it's abelian, then the 0 means that it's...
Yeah, so for SUN, a 1 is saying that it's in the trivial representation. And then N would be the fundamental. For an abelian gauge group, 0 would mean it's in the trivial representation. And Q would mean it just has charge Q. So if it's something is purely a singlet under everything, like the right-handed neutrino field, it would be 1, 1, 0. That is trivial under everything. OK, Higgs field was a singlet under SU3, a doublet under SU2, and then it had hypercharge 1 half. OK. So we have this matrix, and then it acts on 1 over the square root of 2, 0, v plus h. So we can keep going and expanding things out. I'm just going to show you the end result, because today in tutorial, you're going to fill in some of these steps yourself. So ultimately, if I want to write down the entire covariant derivative term, I want to write down d mu h dagger d mu h. And if I just take what I have here and expand it all out, I get the following. So I'll still have a kinetic term for the Higgs fields. And then I get mass terms for the gauge fields. And those mass terms look like this. So I have g squared v squared over 8 for w1 and w2 times 1 plus h over v squared. And then I also have a term that goes like 1 eighth v squared times g w3 mu minus b mu times g prime. And then all of this is squared. And then it's multiplying 1 plus h over v squared. OK, so this is what I get once I expand everything out. What I want to do is figure out the masses of these gauge fields. So I want to have effectively a mass matrix, or mass terms, that are diagonal in the gauge fields. For these gauge fields, Here, you can see that they are not diagonal. There are terms, if I just factor this, that mix B and W3. So in order to figure out the masses, I want to diagonalize those mass terms. So it's convenient just to make a field redefinition. The mass eigenstates of this theory are not going to be W3 or B mu, but they will be linear combinations of those two fields. So I just need to do a rotation. So I want to define new fields. So I'm going to call one of them Z. So rotation is just we're rotating the two components by an angle. That angle is denoted by theta W. The W stands for weak mixing angle. And it will just be a linear combination of the two original gauge fields that I started with. And then I'll have another orthogonal component, which I'll call A mu. Okay, theta W is a weak mixing angle. And I'm also going to abbreviate CW as cosine theta W and SW as sine theta W. Okay, so I want to transform this expression into this basis in terms of these other gauge fields. The other definition I want to make is that you can see the W1 and W2 will have the same mass. And because they pair up in this way, here I have two real gauge fields, I can think of them as a single complex gauge field. So I can define a complex field, W mu plus and minus, which is 1 over square root of 2, W mu 1 minus plus I W mu 2, like this. All right, so you can figure out what this mixing angle is just given the parameters of this mass matrix that you get here. And what you'll have to show is that the mixing angle is defined as follows, or is given as follows. So the tangent of theta W is G prime over G. All right, so the mixing angle is just given in terms of these gauge couplings. OK, skipping some steps. We can keep expanding things out. And what you get is the following. So once I do a change of basis to in terms of these new fields, I have the kinetic term still, plus mass terms, which are now diagonalized. So I have g squared, v squared over 4, w mu plus, w mu minus. Times 1 plus h over v squared. And then I have plus 1 eighth g squared v squared over cosine theta w times z mu, 1 plus h over v squared. OK, so now I can read off, now that I've diagonalized all of the mass terms, what the masses are for these fields. We have a mass for the W, which is G times V over 2. And we have a mass for the Z, which is the same thing, except we also have this additional factor of cosine theta W in the numerator. OK, so this is nice. First of all, I have three massive gauge fields, W plus, W minus, and Z. And their masses are not exactly the same. I have the two complex components, which have, of course, have the same mass. But then I have a different mass for the other gauge fields, for the Z. And also, we know experimentally that the mass of the Z is larger than the mass of the W. That also fits into this picture. Cosine of an angle is always going to be less than 1, and so that means this mass always has to be greater or equal to that mass. Okay, so it seems to work. Okay, so we have three parameters. Mw, mz, and also cosine theta w. We can measure all three of them independently. We can measure the mass of the w, the mass of the z, and as we'll see, the weak mixing angle will also enter into the couplings of those gauge bosons. So by measuring the couplings, independent of how we measure the masses, we can have an independent measurement of this weak mixing angle. And so the prediction of this picture of symmetry breaking is that I can form a ratio, rho, which is mw squared over mz squared cosine theta w squared. And this should be equal to 1. I can measure each of these things independently. I just form this ratio, which should be equal to 1. And I can test this. Of course, yeah?
Do we have a particular reason that we set the hypercharge to 2.5? Beginning, or is that like another free parameter?
It's not a free parameter, but it's what you need in order to get this picture to work.
That's not like an experimentally.
No, it's purely phenomenologically motivated. So, for example, if we had chosen the hypercharge to be 0, that would mean that the U1 hypercharge would be unbroken. And all of the symmetry breaking would just occur for the SU2 left gauge fields. The situation would be very similar to what we had before for the non-abelian Higgs model. We'd get masses for the W and the Z that are the same, plus a massless U1, which would we had to try to identify as the photon. But it wouldn't be viable experimentally, because we know that the masses of the W and the Z are not equal to each other. OK, so this is the prediction from this picture of how we break the electroweak symmetry. It's equal to 1. This parameter rho is equal to 1. I should say it's only equal to 1 at tree level. You can compute, in principle, radiative corrections, loop diagrams that also contribute to rho. And those have been computed precisely. And you can make a precision test of the standard model in this way. On the other hand, if you had other sources of electroweak symmetry breaking, say we introduced new Higgs fields with other quantum numbers, which also could get a VeV, you'd have additional contributions to this parameter rho. So that's something that I think you're going to test on the homework over the weekend. How, if you introduce other scalar fields that get VeVs, does rho change? And so this is a test of this picture where electroweak symmetry breaking only happens through one complex doublet. Yes?
What process are you measuring to measure theta w? Like, I can imagine mw and mz, but what are you doing to measure theta w experimentally?
Yeah, we're going to see how theta w enters into the couplings. So it'll enter into the couplings of these gauge bosons, w and z, with the fermion fields. So you can measure, for example, a scattering process involving the fermions that will be sensitive to the weak mixing angle.
And also, what happens with the gauge Lagrangian, like the traces? Because you're combining these generators, right?
Yeah, that's right. So you have terms in the gauge part of the Lagrangian, in particular from the non-abelian gauge group, the SU2 left. Originally, once you have just the SU2 left gauge fields, you have couplings only amongst the Ws. You'll have a 3-point interaction and a 4-point interaction just for the W, 1, 2, and 3 fields. But now, if you mix them up, you're going to have couplings between the W, the Z, and also the other field as well. And I should mention, and maybe it's obvious, that we had the W and the Z get masses. But the last gauge field degree of freedom, which was this A mu, does not get a mass. And so that is the photon. So I can write down the mass for the photon. It's equal to 0. But once you start including the gauge interactions, you'll have couplings between Zs and photons and the Ws. They'll all get mixed up together. OK. All right, so this is looking pretty good. We know in the standard model we have three massive gauge fields. One of them has a different mass than the other two. Plus, the fourth one is massless. So this seems pretty consistent with what we have observationally in the standard model. We started out with two gauge groups. So we have this picture of electroweak symmetry breaking. We start out with two gauge groups, SE2 left and U1 y. And when the Higgs acquires its VEV, this gets broken down. But we are still left with one unbroken gauge degree of freedom. We still have one massless gauge boson in the theory. That's the photon. And so we write that this electroweak symmetry group gets broken to the U1 of electromagnetism. OK, where now the gauge field for the photon is a linear combination of W3 and the hypercharged gauge field B mu. OK. So far, so good. Next, we want to talk about the fermion terms. So we have the Dirac Lagrangian for all of the different fermions psi. And what I'll do is I'll just expand out this sum just to write everything explicitly so you can see what's going on. So first of all, we'll have a sum over all of the generational indices, I, which goes from 1 to 3. Now we have the left-handed quark fields. Now we have the I here, covariant derivative, d slash plus I, g over 2, sigma a, w a mu, or I should say that it should be a slash, plus I, g prime. The hypercharge of this left-handed quark field was a sixth, so I should plug in a sixth here, times b mu. And then I have the color part, which is I times gs. I have the generator. The generator is just the Gell-Mann matrix divided by 2. So I'll write this as lambda A over 2. And then we have GA mu. Or actually, no, sorry, it should be slash. And then Q left I. OK, so that's the whole covariant derivative for one of the quark fields, Q left. Now I'll just write it down for all the others as well. We have the right-handed up-type quark. Plus I g prime times 2/3 b mu plus I gs lambda a over 2 g slash a u right I. It's similar. I just need to change the hypercharge from a 6 to 2/3. And then there's no SE2 part because it's a right-handed field. Then I have the down type quark. I have to keep going. I still have leptons. And then I have the right-handed lepton. Okay. Okay, a lot of writing. Now, why did I write all this out? Well, we want to figure out what are the gauge interactions for all of these fields. So that'll be the more complicated part. But before we do that, I just want to show you that all of the simpler parts of these interactions, or these terms, like the kinetic terms, and the couplings to gluons, all pair up in the usual way. We started out with a theory where the fields are chiral. They have different interactions for left and right-handed fields. And so I just want to show you just explicitly that the left and right-handed contributions all pair up in the same way, or in a straightforward way. So let's just look at the d slash terms. So for example, we have to look at q left I d slash q left I plus u right I d slash u right I plus d right I d slash d right I. And this I can expand out in terms of the left-handed quarks. Left-handed up-type quarks, left-handed down-type quarks. So once I multiply out in SE2 space, I get u left I d slash u left I plus d left bar I d slash d left I. And then I just have these same terms I had before. Okay, so you can see it's straightforward. The left-handed terms and the right-handed terms all just pair up in the straightforward way. And so you just get the following. Okay, so even though we started with a chiral theory, we can write it straightforwardly as a four-component Dirac fermion. OK, it works the same way for the gluon terms because the left and right-handed spinners have the same SU3 quantum numbers. So I won't expand it out in detail, but you get the following, minus GS with the gauge fields, GA mu. And then we have U bar I gamma mu. We have the generator, lambda A over 2, UI. Plus d bar I gamma mu lambda A over 2 di. OK, so the gluon terms also pair up just in terms of four component objects. Oh, out of time. Tomorrow, and I think also during tutorial, we're going to talk about what happens to the electroweak interactions of the gauge fields, the W, the Z, and the photon, with the fermion fields. So we'll write down what those interactions look like. Okay, that's all for today.